Laudator Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges and I'll be with you over the next half hour. Coming up on today's program, more than meets the eye, we bring you our weekly reflection on the Sunday Gospel reading prepared by Jill Bevilacqua. And Joan Knows, our resident Vatican watcher Joan Lewis, takes us back over the past week's events in the Vatican. As usual, we begin today's broadcast with Jill Bevilacqua's programme, There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye, with readings by Sean Patrick Lovett.
Jesus was arraigned before the procurator, Pontius Pilate, who questioned him, Are you the king of the Jews? Jesus responded, As you say. Yet when he was accused by the chief priests and elders, he made no reply. Then Pilate said to him, Surely you hear how many charges they bring against you. He did not answer him on a single count, much to the procurator's surprise. Now on the occasion of a festival, the procurator was accustomed to release one prisoner, whom the crowd would designate. They had, at the time, a notorious prisoner named Barabbas. Since they were already assembled, Pilate said to them, Which one do you wish me to release for you, Barabbas or Jesus, the so-called Messiah? He knew, of course, that it was out of jealousy that they had handed him over. While he was still presiding on the bench, his wife sent him a message, Do not interfere in the case of that holy man. I had a dream about him today, which has greatly upset me. Meanwhile, the chief priests and elders convinced the crowds that they should ask for Barabbas and have Jesus put to death. So when the procurator asked them, Which one do you wish me to release for you? They said, Barabbas. Pilate said to them, Then what am I to do with Jesus, the so-called Messiah? Crucify him, they all cried. He said, Why? What crime has he committed? But they only shouted the louder, Crucify him. Pilate finally realized that he was making no impression and that a riot was breaking out instead. He called for water and washed his hands in front of the crowd, declaring as he did so, I am innocent of the blood of this just man. The responsibility is yours. The whole people said in reply, Let his blood be on us and on our children. At that, he released Barabbas to them. Jesus, however, he first had scourged, then he handed him over to be crucified. The procurator's soldiers took Jesus inside the praetorium and collected the whole cohort around him. They stripped off his clothes and wrapped him in a scarlet military cloak. Weaving a crown out of thorns, they fixed it on his head and stuck a reed in his right hand. Then they began to mock him by dropping to their knees before him, saying, All hail, King of the Jews! They also spat at him. Afterward, they took hold of the reed and kept striking him on the head. Finally, when they had finished making a fool of him, they stripped him of the cloak, dressed him in his own clothes, and led him off to crucifixion.
Time was when the gospel for this day was looked on as a kind of marathon. Who would last out the longest? Standing, that is. At school, the nuns promised that if we managed to keep perfectly still for the whole of what was known as the long gospel, we'd help to reduce the time souls were serving in purgatory. Well, those were the days. Today, with the reform of the liturgy, not only do we not have a long gospel, we even have a short form of the shorter gospel. And so we're plunged headlong into the trial of Jesus before Pontius Pilate, the Roman procurator or prefect of Judea and Samaria, the man who's gone down in history as the one who ordered the crucifixion of our Lord, but also for certain words and gestures during the trial. What is truth? Said jesting Pilate, and would not stay for an answer. These opening words of Francis Bacon's essay on truth, published in 1625, were taken up 300 years later by another essayist, Aldous Huxley, who entitled a collection, Jesting Pilot. Whether Pilate was jesting or not, we shall never know. We know only that when Jesus declared that he came into the world to give testimony to the truth, Pilate exclaimed, "What is truth?" and then turned away. Ever since, people have been asking themselves what he meant by his question. "Truth? Is that all?" suggests Sheed, reminding us that the Roman Empire was littered with philosophers, sophists, and mystics.
The Roman civil service was trained to treat them with a sort of contemptuous tolerance. There might even be something in the stuff they were talking, but nothing that interested practical men above all, nothing that threatened Roman dominion. The Jesus whom they wanted him to kill for them was evidently one of that mystical sort.
H.V. Morton offers a different view.
Pilate looked into the eyes of Christ and expressed in three words the hunger of the pagan world. What is truth?
John is the only one of the evangelists who reports this celebrated question. Let's listen to it in context, in the Jerusalem Bible version.
"So you are a king, then," said Pilate. "It is you who say it," answered Jesus. "Yes, I am a king. I was born for this, I came into the world for this, to bear witness to the truth, and all who are on the side of truth listen to my voice." "Truth," said Pilate, "what is that?" And with that he went out again to the Jews and said, "I find no case against him."
And immediately Pilate offers to release a prisoner according to the Passover custom.
"Would you like me then to release the king of the Jews?"
We know what the answer was. Another celebrated phrase of Pilate's is also reported only in John, but before that comes the scourging, ordered by Pilate in the hopes that when the people see Jesus afterwards, they will be moved by pity. Writes a modern scholar,
"Pilate, by now convinced of the innocence of Jesus, makes a series of attempts to find a way of freeing him. The aim of these is to influence the people who had been incited by the Jewish leaders. Thus, he wishes to achieve justice by devious ways without meeting the difficulties and the unpopularity which justice often brings."
And so Jesus is scourged. And hearing that this prisoner has been accused of wishing to make himself king, the soldiers decide to have some fun with him, wrapping him in a scarlet military cloak, weaving a crown out of thorns, and putting a reed for a sceptre in his right hand. The thorns, we're told, were taken from the faggots which the soldiers kept for lighting fires with which to keep themselves warm during the night watches. And so to that celebrated phrase recorded by John as the scourged and bleeding prisoner is shown to the crowds. "Ecce homo, behold the man," said Pilate. Writes H.V. Morton,
"There was no contempt in his voice. They were the words of a weak but fair-minded man who hoped that the piteous spectacle of the scourged Christ would soften the savage hearts of his enemies. Ecce homo, the sight is one that has aroused the pity and the love of the Christian world."
Many are the artists who have depicted this moment, but in the May of 1373, it was granted to a young woman of 30, apparently at the point of death, to see what no artist saw. But she was no ordinary young woman. Julian of Norwich, in her Revelations of Divine Love, wrote afterwards of her desire to fully experience and understand our Lord's passion, wanting his pain to be her pain, not wanting a physical vision or revelation of God, but, she said, such compassion as a soul would naturally have for our Lord Jesus. And this is what she saw.
"I saw the red blood trickling down from under the garland, hot, fresh and plentiful, just as at the time of his passion. Great drops of blood rolled down from the garland like beads, seemingly from the veins, and they came down a brownish-red colour, for the blood was thick, and as they spread out, they became bright red. They were as fresh and living as though they were real, their abundance like the drops of water that fall from the eaves after a heavy shower, falling so thickly that no one can possibly count them. Their roundness, as they spread out on his forehead, were like the scales of herring. I was reminded of these three things at the time: round beads as the blood flowed, round herring scales as it spread out, and raindrops from the eaves for their abundance. This revelation was real and lifelike, horrifying and dreadful, sweet and lovely.
A poet of our own day, R.S. Thomas, no mystic he, but a deeply religious Welsh clergyman, reflects in a country church. To one kneeling down, no word came, only the wind's song, saddening the lips of the grave saints, rigid in glass, or the dry whisper of unseen wings, bats, not angels, in the high roof. Was he balked by silence? He kneeled long and saw love in a dark crown of thorns blazing and a winter tree golden with fruit of a man's body. Many hymns have been written on the theme of Christ crowned with thorns. One in particular, dating from the 13th century, was harmonised by Bach. Here are the words of the first verse in Ronald Knox's translation of what is known as the Passion Chorale.
O sacred head, ill-used by reeds and brambles scarred, that idle blows have bruised and mocking lips have marred, how dimmed that eye so tender, how wan those cheeks appear, how overcast the splendour that angel hosts revere.
There's another hymn or carol which, though fanciful, I find as moving as any of the more realistic, historically accurate ones. The Crown of Roses is also known as Tchaikovsky's legend, for he set it to music in 1883.
When Jesus Christ was yet a child, he had a garden small and wild, wherein he cherished roses fair and wove them into garlands there. Now once, as summertime drew nigh, there came a troop of children by, and seeing roses on the tree, with shouts they plucked them merrily. "Do you bind roses in your hair?" they cried, in scorn, to Jesus there. The boy said humbly, "Take, I pray, all but the naked thorns away." Then of the thorns they made a crown, and with rough fingers pressed it down, till on his forehead fair and young red drops of blood like roses sprung.
And thanks there to Jill Bevilacqua for that programme. And now, our friend and Vatican watcher Joan Lewis, who's EWTN's Rome Bureau Chief, gives us a roundup of the past week's events here in the Vatican.
OK, Joan, hello. So once again we're here in our studio and going to give us the papal roundup. So let's start with Sunday.
Well, Sunday was very interesting. The Pope visited the city of Carpi, and that's in Italy's northern Emilia-Romagna region. And the city had been largely rebuilt, and much of the region, after deadly earthquakes in 2012. And actually, one of the reasons for the visit, really, the Pope hoped to give hope to those in central Italy who are still living with the devastation caused by quakes, of course, last August and October. Pope Francis stopped at the newly restored, if you will, Cathedral of Carpi, laid a bouquet of flowers at the foot of a statue of Mary, and the cathedral itself had only been opened a week earlier by the Cardinal Secretary of State, Pietro Parolin. Francis told the faithful, "There are those who remain buried in the rubble of life, and those, like you, who, with the help of God, rise from the rubble to rebuild." And then he mentioned that Jesus himself wept for the death of Lazarus, but he didn't allow himself to be imprisoned by pessimism. And then I like what the Pope said about Jesus' words to Lazarus, come out of the tomb. They speak to us, and he says, come out of the impasse, come out of sadness without hope. Untie the bandages of fear that obstruct your path. A very interesting, moving Sunday. Obviously, when he goes out of town, the Pope always has a meeting with religious, with different groups of people.
So, and he did meet also with the families who lost loved ones.
He did. Oh, he did indeed. Mm. Yes.
Okay, let's move on to Tuesday. That there was news of his prayer intention.
Yes, and Tuesday, which is normally a very quiet day for the Pope as he prepares for the Wednesday audience, we did have the, as you said, the papal prayer intention. This comes out in written form. People can find it on the website. But the Holy Father, since January, has been producing a video message for this intention as well. This month was all dedicated to young people. And he said, "I know you young people don't want to be duped by a false freedom, always at the beck and call of momentary fashions and fads. I know you aim high." And then he asked, "Is that true or am I wrong?" And he said, "Don't leave it to others to be protagonists of change. You, young people, are the ones who hold the future. I ask you to be builders of the world, to work for a better world. It's a challenge. It is a challenge. Do you accept it?" I think you're going to be, during the year, in different occasions, hearing a lot more from the Pope about and to young people. Certainly Palm Sunday, this Sunday. Palm Sunday is the 32nd World Youth Day on a diocesan level. But then the next Synod of Bishops, of course, is dedicated to young people. Important words there to the young. And then in another visit, a couple of visits actually on Tuesday, the Holy Father met Prince Charles and his wife Camilla, the Duchess of Cornwall, and you met him later in the day as well, which is wonderful.
Yes.
So this is the fourth day of an Italian tour that they're that has taken them to various places in Italy: Vicenza for a First World War commemoration, to Amatrice, of course, struck by the earthquake, to Florence, where the prince visited a Caritas-run project, and then the Duchess spent a day in Naples meeting with trafficked women and youngsters with learning difficulties. I think what was noteworthy was the gifts that the royals gave to the Holy Father, a basket of goodies from their estate, which they said they put together particularly for the homeless in Rome.
And I'm sure a very welcome gift. And he's
very thoughtful. They know what the Pope's about. They know his love and attention for the homeless. And then another event on Tuesday was the papal address to a conference organized organized by the Vatican Dicastery for Integral Human Development. And this was to mark 50 years of Populorum Progressio. And this was an encyclical written by Pope Paul VI on the topic of the development of peoples, and saying that the economy of the world should serve all of mankind, not just a few. In his address to everyone celebrating this anniversary, the Pope reflected on the word integral, which, of course, is part of this new Vatican Dicastery's name, Integral Human Development. And he said this implies the integration of peoples, so there's no longer that dramatic inequality between those who have too much and those who have nothing. And when you, and I love to have a euro for every single time the Pope has said, has spoken about this inequality.
He also mentioned, didn't he, that this new modern culture, it's exalted the individual to the point of turning it into an island.
Yes, exactly. And again, looking at Integral, he said, this integration of peoples means offering viable models of social integration, so no one is excluded from contributing to society. And in the West, the individual is exalted, and you're losing a sense of community, which is really also one of the things that the Holy Father is stressing. And then there was another important piece of news that came out Tuesday, and that is the announcement that with the approval of Pope Francis, the Pontifical Commission Ecclesia Dei has issued a letter to bishops on the marriages of Catholics who seek to exchange their vows in churches of the Society of St. Pius X, called by many SSPX, which was founded by the late Archbishop Marcel Lefebvre. However, with this letter, we see that the Holy Father, following a proposal by the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith and the Commission Ecclesia Dei, which, by the way, deals strictly with SSPX. With that commission, the Holy Father has decided to authorize local ordinaries, local Catholic bishops, the possibility to grant faculties for the celebration of marriages of faithful who follow the pastoral activity of the society.
Okay, let's move on to Wednesday.
The morning began, obviously Wednesday is always the general audience. It was in St. Peter's Square. But before the audience, the Holy Father did meet a delegation of Muslim leaders from Great Britain. He had very brief words to them, but I loved it. These are the Pope's words. "I like to think the most important task we must do together in humanity is the work of the ear, listening to each other." He said, "Listening without haste to give an answer, welcoming the word of our brother, our sister, and then thinking of giving our own." But he said the capacity to listen, this is very important. He said it's interesting when people have this capacity for listening, they speak with a low and calm tone. Instead, when they don't have this, they speak loudly and even shout. I really kind of sat back.
Very insightful.
Very insightful. How many times have you seen people on television who are not listening to each other, where there should be dialogue, people are shouting?
So, it's a babble.
An interesting meeting. And then, of course, the Pope went into the square and once again meditated on Christian hope. The theme of last Wednesday was giving a reason for the hope that is in us. And it's interesting, in talking about hope and talking about the upcoming Holy Week and so forth, in off-the-cuff remarks, he noted that in this Easter time, the days of Easter, especially after, obviously, he said Slavic peoples, when they greet each other, instead of saying good morning or good evening, they greet each other with "Christ is risen," which is so important. Because, again, the Holy Father was pointing to the resurrection, the passion, death, resurrection of Christ as giving all of us hope. And that is why he mentioned this. By the way, the Holy Father, after the catechesis on hope, he did decry the attacks. He made two appeals, really. One was the attack in St. Petersburg, Russia, on the metro. And then the Holy Father also spoke of the horror of the attacks in Syria and appealing for a political solution there. Francis said, "With horror, we witness the events that have taken place in Syria." And that happened in the Idlib province, where, as the Pope said, scores of helpless people, including many children, were killed.
And he described it as unacceptable carnage.
So. Oh, yes, absolutely. Another thing that the Pope mentioned at the audience after the catechesis on hope was he recalled the 12th anniversary of the death of Pope St. John Paul just days earlier on April 2nd, 2005, and the Pope's great messages of the merciful Jesus and of Fatima. And of course, he spoke of the Fatima anniversary next month, 100 years of the apparitions at Fatima.
And he's going to Fatima in May.
And he's going for 2 days in May, obviously, to mark that. So another brief trip for him, but how meaningful. Wouldn't we all love to be on the papal plane with him?
Absolutely. Let's go on to Thursday.
Thursday, the Vatican announced something. I remember talking about this last weekend when we were mentioning that the Vatican had released last week the papal schedule for Holy Week, and we know most of the events. But this year they didn't mention anything about the Mass of the Lord's Supper, but we learned that on Thursday. The Vatican did announce that the Pope will travel to a penitentiary on the afternoon of April 13th, that's Thursday, for a private visit and the celebration of Mass marking Jesus' Last Supper with his disciples. Now, he's going to this Paliano prison. This is south of Rome for Mass, during which time he will wash the feet of inmates. And if our listeners remember, the Pope began this tradition, if you will, of traveling to a prison for the Last Supper just days after his inauguration as Pope. He went to Rome's Casa del Marmo Youth Detention Center. Then in 2014, he went to the Don Gnocchi Center for the Disabled, included women among those whose feet were washed. In 2015, Pope Francis went to Rome's Rebibbia prison. And in 2016, he washed the feet of refugees, including Muslims, Hindus, and Coptic Orthodox men and women. Just continuing a tradition that he himself has invented
of not just priests.
Having that Mass. Well, yes, and not having that Mass just in St. Peter's Basilica. So
going out to the peripheries.
Exactly.
Or the marginalized.
Our Holy Father's middle name, periphery. And then we also learned on Thursday that Pope Francis sent a letter to Cardinal Blaise Supich of Chicago in support of local efforts to promote nonviolence. Now, the Chicago Archdiocese has launched a campaign on nonviolence. They did this on April 4th to coincide with the 49th anniversary of the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King. I had forgotten it had been that long. So the event, this campaign for nonviolence, culminates with a March for Peace on Good Friday.
And this was prompted by the fact they're having so many murders in Chicago.
Oh, the murder rate is just absolutely astounding. Almost all in the south side of Chicago. And obviously Cardinal Supich wants to create dialogue, show, wait a minute, if there's problems, we don't need violence. Mm. So in his letter, Pope Francis assured the people of Chicago of his support for this initiative and of his prayers for those who, quote, have lost loved ones to violence. And he said that he will remember the city in prayer as he leads the way of the cross in Rome that same day. Of course, that's Good Friday at the Colosseum when he will be doing that.
Okay, well, thank you very much for that.
Well, wishing you a wonderful, blessed, happy Holy Week and Easter.
And the same to you, Joan. And we'll meet up again after Easter.
We will.
And I was talking there to Vatican watcher Joan Lewis, who's EWTN's Rome Bureau Chief. And that's all we have time for today. Thanks so much for joining us here on Vatican Radio. I'm Susie Hodges, and until next time, Laudator Jesus Christus.